All right, so today is March 19th, 2013, officially the last day of winter, although you wouldn't know it. My name is Troy Reeves with the UW-Mass Oral History Program. I'm here with Chris Clark. We're here at the Porter Boathouse. So, Chris, when we last talked, you had been asked to, I guess, be an unpaid assistant at Navy, but we didn't actually get you there. So I wonder if you could start by getting there, your initial thoughts about being a coach, and we'll go from there.
Yeah, that was a good situation. The only later I learned, I mean, I ended up being there for 2 years, but only later did I learn that we had a very good group with the freshman team that year. I didn't realize how good it was until later. I thought it was always going to be easy like that, and it was just a great group of guys, too, who are still pretty tight even today from the academy, and occasionally I hear from them, but they're definitely tight with their coach, Nan Lyons, who was their Naval Academy grad 1981, who was their coach, mm-hmm. and who I was a buddy with, and it was so much fun, and we had such a good time that year, and then it really locked me down for coaching. And then the next year, a little more reality set in. A lot of good talent that helped build Navy for the future, but not as good as a freshman group, so it was more challenging. But they were still pretty good. But still, at that point, I was all in. So mm-hmm. the Naval Academy is it's interesting, all the kids, when they're there, you never ever hear anybody say, man, I love it here. I'm not sure they even say it 20 years later. But when you're a civilian there, it's this beautiful taxpayer-funded park, mm-hmm. essentially the name. And that's the way I took it. I lived there in the summer of 93, between the 2 years that I was there. And it was right at some of the officers actually lived there. One officer and his family, they had an extra little apartment. I stayed there. It was great. Which is, again, you talk to any Navy person, they probably shiver because it means authority and God knows what, but not for a civilian. It means a good time. And you're not bothered by anybody for the most part. It's just a beautiful, well-groomed, idyllic place. It was great. I loved it, every minute of it. And there was times in my career that had I been opportunity to go back there, I definitely would have. It's just now that I'm Midwest, so mm-hmm. I couldn't do it. And then in the summer of 94, in other words, after the second year, Dan Lyons and I, he threw a rowing club in Philadelphia, Penn AC. We wanted to go row at Henley. And, in retrospect, we thought we were serious about it. And we were, but we made it to the semifinals, I think, of the event we were in. But the reason why that's important was Jabbo, right before we left, I came for an interview with Jabbo. And I was here a couple of days. I do remember this, though, that this is, say, June 17th or 18th or something of 1994. I flew to Chicago and drove up. It was hot. It was like 99 or 100, record heat. And I just remember, even though I had been here before, thinking, I'm not going to make it if it's this hot. I can't handle it. And it just seemed shockingly hot, even though I was already in Philly and, Annapolis, which aren't cool places. I didn't realize, I don't know if I've hardly ever seen that kind of heat here again, but that was one impression I had. But I certainly liked it. And then anyway, we go to Henley, we roll there, and then Jabbo, this is pre-cell phones, or right on the verge of cell phones. Jabbo, I do remember, though, when we were driving around, he took me to various places in 19, including the Essen House at least a couple of times. The Jabbo had one of those big brick Motorola cell phones, those giant things, the size of this 2 liter or this liter Dr. Pepper that I have right now. Mm-hmm. I thought, wow, that's pretty slick. And anyway, he calls me at Henley and offers me the job. And I thought about it a bit because I understood what it meant for me personally. I didn't know anybody here, even though I had been here. And I was confident, you're going to meet people, except, but still, there was no, and all my friends were on coasts on either side. It's not like anybody lived around here. And I thought long and hard, and I thought, all right, this is a watershed moment for me, taking this job, and I did. And then got here in July of of 94. I can't remember exactly when. Say around the 15th or something. And I do, of July, I do remember, though, that SOAR, which we had talked about before, I inherited from Jabbo the idea that it was important. And I eventually sort of passed that on to Greg Meyer, who was my, who's now the coach at the University of Pennsylvania, but who was the freshman coach, my successor. This concept that it was important, but we never went any deeper than that, that we actually, there's things you could do to make it more effective or have a professional approach to it, which we really didn't. That didn't mean I missed it. We just didn't strategize. It was just, oh, well, maybe these guys will show up, and we had enough confidence to think we'd make them good. I've learned in some groups you can't make good no matter what. Mm-hmm. So that's probably why we redoubled it. But I do remember that Mary Browning, who was the novice coach at the time, Mary Lockyer, I think she was going by that, was her. She did all, some of the recruiting for us, and it wasn't ideal only because she's a women's coach and a coxswain, not a. But it didn't even faze me at all. So anyway, I was here that summer, and I don't know where my crack staff is the joking term that Meyer came up with for our helpers. These are fifth years volunteer coaches, student assistants, people of that nature. Now that there's official, you know, the paperwork, the procedure now compared to what it used to be. Before it was just guys would show up and help. Now, you know, someone can't step foot here without filling out 10 forms and getting literally a background check. But at the time, I had 3 crack staff, and I don't think I met him in the summer. And fortunately, I did. That was another thing I didn't think about, is that you need bodies to help you here. It's not like a bucolic little man-made river or lake like in Princeton that is made for rowing by Andrew Carnegie, or a little perfect little river. It's a difficult place to be. So somewhere along the way, I met those guys. They must have just shown up. I had 3 of them. Luke Bogdanovich, who was a 94, who went to Memorial High School here in Madison. Chuck Stolenwerk was also a 94. He's from Milwaukee, went to Marquette High School. And then Alex Flackus, who from Oconomowoc area. Luke is a dentist now, I think, up in the Twin Cities. Chuck Stolenwerk now is a coach at Milwaukee School of Engineering. They have a new varsity program, rowing program there. And then Alex Flackus is, I'm not sure what he is, but I know he's spent time in combat situation in Iraq and maybe Afghanistan. Oh, and Afghanistan. And I don't know who he works for. Defense Department, CIA. He's not particularly secretive, but I don't ask him. Don't ask, don't tell. Mm-hmm. So I think he might be deployed in Europe now doing something. I don't know what. But those were the crack staff. It's very close to my heart, though. They're great guys. Anyway, so we start, and I do remember the very first practice I ever came down to. Jabbo unexpectedly started practice a week before school starts, which you can't do anymore based on the rules. You could if you're in there's certain circumstances, but we don't fall in that. Rowing doesn't. And at the time, I don't think there was any rules at all. Anyway, they started twice a day for the first week before school started and the first week, which is really the only time that he would ever go twice. I do remember that first practice was a free-for-all. It was pretty funny. This is not freshman at this point. So, and they were kind of in a... The team was hitting a nadir. They really had hit bottom for various reasons, I would say, but not the least of which was the rise of the foreign rower had come in and changed the sport dramatically. So I want to say in 1992 at the championships, I think Wisconsin, and this is a time when Harvard and Yale didn't even go, and Cal and Washington only went some of the time in 1992, and Wisconsin was 6th in the championship. But and you take out those crews who were good, it would have been even worse, which 6th isn't that bad. But then, even without those crews in 93 and 94, they weren't even anywhere near the final, and they were just dropping. So I came here right at that time. I knew I could impact the team with more motivated and good freshmen. There were decent guys on the team, but just for whatever reason, it wasn't... well, there's various reasons that I don't really want to say, I think, that that it had hit bottom. And some was conflict with the freshman coach, Dan Gain, who... he's a 80-something grad here. And he and Jabbo... he was a loyal lieutenant to Jabbo, and he was my predecessor. and I think they clashed a lot. Well, I know they did. And they, neither one was happy with the situation for 5 or 6 years, and that can lead to not a benign situation. So anyway, and you combine that with the fact that the sport had changed. You know, it had gone more, quote, professional in Europe. So my first meeting here, I do remember it. You know, now we have three separate meetings. These are what we don't call them meetings. We call them orientations for various reasons. But the very first kid that came was turned out to be one of our best alumni. And he was captain in 1998, Nelson Williams. He's from Memorial, graduated high school in 94. Now he's the CEO of this company in Milwaukee called Bryon, a big construction company. And a funny guy, like, but he was the very first guy to come to the meeting we had, my very first meeting ever here. So, but I still remember him coming first. And then, you know, from there, we've had, there's a lot of detail, but just being a freshman coach, you learned a lot along the way. It was great.
So,
and then you get to the point where I was promoted, right? Well, this, there, not that it's irrelevant, the rest of it, but still, it was a learning process for me. We had a lot of success. It was good. And at the same time, the varsity crews got better slowly. It took 2 years. It takes a couple of years to get your guys up on the varsity and making a difference, and it really did. I've always thought if I wasn't promoted, how long would it have taken for Jabbo to retire? You know, at that point, I had met my now wife, who graduated law school here in 1995. But still, you know, we weren't married. We didn't have children, so who knows? I don't think I could have been prepared to stay here 5 more years and waiting. I don't really know. So,
I mean, you did, at least according to the bio on the athletics website, your freshmen did have
a lot of success. Yeah, they did. And it came fairly easy to me. And the longer you go, though, in something, you probably don't build more confidence, you build less, just because you run in different situations. There's always something new every year. And hubris doesn't help anything. And setbacks. So sometimes I'll even look back and go, God, how did we have so much success? I don't know. We did. And it just came from confidence and knowing that we could make it happen here.
So I guess I didn't check this out. Did Jabbo officially retire? Is that why you were promoted?
No, what happened was, is Jabbo came from the old school, there's no question, and he would he could relate to that. And would agree to that. And sort of the accounting practices and the way things used to work then were much different than today. I mean, completely different. There weren't checks and balances. And there's the old legend that, I got to remember her name, but there was a woman here when I got here who had been here since the 1950s. And at one point, the entire athletic department operated out of the trunk of her car. And simply because it was just the way things were done. And I know when Barry Alvarez came along, that's when things started to really professionalize as well, and Pat Richter. And Jabbo hit the way he was doing accounting, which was just an old school, back in the envelope type operation. That eventually got him to this point where the athletic department, Joel Maturi, who became the, you know, the AD at Minnesota, he basically said, all right, Jabbo, this can be your last year. But and I want to say that was November of 1996. My third year of coaching freshman, and he brought me in and just said, all right, you're the varsity coach now. And he said, here's your option. I'll never forget this. You can keep Jabbo on for the remainder of the year or let him go. Of course I said keep him on as varsity, at coaching the varsity both. But I thought about that afterward. Let's just say that for whatever reason I couldn't stand Jabbo, which is certainly not the case, but let's pretend. It would have been an incredibly bad situation to do anything about it anyway, simply because you would have been hated by all my forever for something you had absolutely no control over. So it worked perfectly, actually. And I think Jabbo, impetus-wise, it worked well for him. I think it, you know, they had a very good year. They finished just a few seconds out of winning the title. They were fourth best finish in 7 or 8 years, so he really went off on a high. It was great. So I was happy for him, and it all worked out. Mm-hmm. So, again, I don't know how long. You'd have to ask him how long he would have coached. And then who knows, maybe, I don't know. But it worked out well. Jab has been extremely supportive. And one thing I'll say, after I became head coach, he hardly was around. And he's repeated more than once. He said, I wasn't around if you needed me, but I didn't want to be looming, you know, mm-hmm. over your shoulder, which was very nice. And he's there as a resource if I needed him, even today. But again, their coaching, head coaching changes here are seldom, since there's only been two since 1946 changes.
Right.
So what's that, 54, 64, 67 years, there's been twice there's been a transition. It's not a lot. So
that, so the 96, which would actually be 96, 97?
I was the head coach.
You were the head coach?
But Jabbo coached the varsity, right? Okay. I just continued coaching. Remember I talked about my diploma being that I actually finished, but it says, it's the same kind of, mm-hmm. people ask me how long you've been head coach. Well, technically, since 96, 97. So I'm actually coaching the varsity not until 98.
So what, if any, changes did you make once, you know, you not only were head men's coach, but also coaching the varsity? So that would be, what, 97?
97,
98. Yeah.
I just stepped up the training more to reflect the modern era. And, you know, we essentially went to nine times. You know, on average, during 20 hours, meaning 6 days a week, 20 hours, when you're able to practice at that rate, we went to nine practices a week, usually. I mean, an ideal situation would be, at least when we're rowing, is row twice Monday, Tuesday afternoon, twice Wednesday, Thursday afternoon, twice Friday, Saturday once. So that was part of it. Mm-hmm. And guys in the past were never asked to train like that. I just said, keep your schedules open, just make it happen. Well, I have a lab, figure it out. And they do figure it out. Mm-hmm. They either take summer school or they get, if they're going to have a conflict, they'll do it in the fall, which when it's less important, et cetera. Teams have never figured that out. They have a very different scenario. They don't have the flexibility like we do. Mm. However, but most of our, at least half of our people are engineers, so it can be done if you just make the demand. Mm. And they do. They rise to it. Works out well. That's one change. We started rowing more. At the very end of Jabbo's tenure, we started rowing in the other parts of the lake more, over at Marshall Park. In spring of 97 is when we first started going over there. It took me over 2 years I was here. I didn't realize what a great resource that is over there. It just didn't occur to me. Mm-hmm. We started getting new launches as well, new power boats, which we needed these, you know, for safety. We used to, we had no lifts out here for boats. All the boats were kept in the boat bays, which meant not only did it take up space, that it also helped in its own subtle way to keep you from practicing more, because if it wasn't perfect, God, we have to take the power boats out. Mm-hmm. So all those, that's another innovation. I mean, there's a lot of innovations. I had racks built to keep boats in remote places. We docks instead of piers, so they go up and down with the water level. Turning spring break into somewhat of an event, we did. What else? There's a lot more than that. I just can't remember. But all this, part of it was made possible by an athletic department that made a lot more money than he used to make. You know, Jabbo was part of the era when, you know, again, it was run out of some trunk. So they didn't have any money. But we just have had a lot more. So I've been able to do pretty much what we needed to do, which has been nice.
So, powerboats, how do that?
We probably only had 4 or 5 total. Now we have 14 out here that we use.
Okay.
Part of it was the addition of lightweight women's rowing, which added another team. But imagine they were all kept inside the boat bays. Except when you row, you guys would get the trailer, slide it out, launch it every practice. Mm-hmm. That was another thing that kept us from practicing a lot, because it was a hassle. There was no docks out there. I mean, no piers and lifts. So that was another change we made. Made a big difference, though. And the ability to row it by having racks and by increasing the inventory, you're able to keep boats all over the lake. And having power boats and the ability to get vans. That getting vans and transportation is easier than it used to be. Mm-hmm. So you can either transport people to the remote practice spot or just take them in the power boats.
Mm-hmm.
which we do a lot. But that just didn't happen when Java was here because they didn't have money to pay for it.
Mm-hmm. So when you said you had met your now wife, but wasn't wife then, when did marriage and family start?
I got married in September of 1997. First kid born August of 2000.
And how have you balanced work and home?
One advantage of being a coach, though, is your schedule. You know, when it's busy, it's busy. You're not there hardly at all. But when you're in sort of regular training, you know, the intense time is morning and afternoon, but time to drop by during the day and do things, which is nice. That's a nice kid sick. You can bring them home. All those kind of flexibility you don't have in a more office-y 9-to-5, that's mm-hmm. a positive. And but it isn't easy, yeah, there's no question. And for example, you realize that in April and May and early June, well, even in March, you'll never go anywhere with your kids, ever, because you can't. Mm-hmm. It's the busiest time. So, again, my family's ready to go to spring break again. And I think this will be the 32nd time my son has been flown to Florida, 32nd time. Now, obviously, he's only 12, but he's gone almost 3 times a year. And of those times, I've probably been with him 10. So that's a problem. In the summer, you had more flexibility. That was another innovation here was when I first got here, I'd come down to row on the rowing machine, and we had two boatmen, Hans Borscherding, class of 86, I think, and Roger Payne, who had been here for a few years and now is a boatman at Virginia. And it was just them and one other kid that worked here, a helper. No one rowed out of this boathouse. And over the years, Greg Meyer in particular started with Camp Randall Rowing Club. And a few kids would stay in the summer and row. And then all of a sudden now, like last year, this is excluding the women who have their own thing going now. We had 45 guys here rowing into June to beginning of August. It's changed a lot. It's changed a lot, and there's two meanings to that. One, it's changed a lot because it used to not be here, and two, it's changed our competitiveness. It's helped a lot. It's this year-round job. You have that plus the SOAR, you know, which goes for 2 months, so you're locked down here. It's another problem. You can't really go anywhere in those months. And, you know, people, I don't have any free time. Not till later in August. You know, it's better when you don't actually have a direct college team, which you don't in the summer. You're responsible for a lot of things, but not the day-to-day. Like right now, it's much easier than that, even though we have a lot of people rowing here. So, but as far as being busy, can't go anywhere. I think it's probably 36, 37 weekends a year, or weeks a year. You're 6 to 7 days a week. And again, it isn't ditch digging or being a mover, but you still have to do it. So it really affects your ability to go places and do things when other people can't. Mm-hmm.
Is there an easy way to describe... you sort of did there, but I guess maybe sort of officially look at it in terms of seasons. So right now we're finishing winter, entering spring.
Starting in the fall, I start usually the second week of school, because I want them to enjoy that first week. There's various reasons for that, but not the least of which I'll get to, is that they've rowed a lot in the summer. They've rowed or worked out in a serious manner 12 months out of the year. Not in the entire 12 months, but most of them have rowed up through, you know, 8th or 9th of August. So let's give them a month off at that point. I want them to have 28, 30 days to do whatever they want and enjoy themselves. And we take the first few weekends off, too. We don't even row till the end of September. But we're rowing a lot at that time, as much as we can. We avoid the rowing machines, because that will come later. And we row as much as we can up through usually the weekend before Thanksgiving is when we get off the water. We've gone to a few races generally. We used to go to more races, but with the advent of the implementation of, at least at our institution, of Title IX, when you race your first intercollegiate race with outside competition, you have to name your squad, and that number, if they're doing a gender, if they're roster management, that count. So it makes perfect sense that we would race later because our team will be smaller. Mm-hmm. And but the women race early because their team is bigger. It works perfect. So they race much earlier than we do. They have a couple of races before we do. And then our first is the head of the trials. And then there's usually only a couple after that, random small regattas. One is in Iowa. But we're all done by right before Thanksgiving. And then depending on the rules in the year, we can usually go through about December 6th or 7th or 8th or 9th. Usually by the 10th we're done. And then we pick up at the exact same time again. Every first practice in Austin, Texas is December 28th, period. That's when it is. And it runs through the morning of January 10th. So it's 2 weeks of training. And then regardless of when school starts, they always get 14 days off from that day after Texas. So they've had over 14 before and get another 14. You know, good guys are training on their own anyway, but training on your own versus, you know, the forced march of what Archer is very different. And it's good for them academically, and it's good for them psychologically. And then we pick up again, so that, you know, that's whenever that is, January 24th, 5th, or whatever. And we're in 8 hours at that point. Remember, 8 hours a week, 5 days a week. We don't go to 20 usually until February 20th or so. So we usually take the first couple of weekends off just to let them, again, for the same reason we do it earlier in the fall. And then we're in getting in the heart of, we're past the heart of winter, theoretically, right now. And I think the lake has, on the average, since I've been here, broken about March 26th. That's not going to happen this year, but it's gone as late as April 10th in 2008, and a couple other times it's been into April. But it affects us now only because we have a Michigan race that we began in 1999, a home race here. They come here. So in 96, when it went into April, we didn't have the race, so it didn't impact us. 2001, we had the race, but it was on one of those weekends that was a week later than, you know, it depends on how the calendar goes. And I want to say the lake broke on April 4th or 5th, so we were able to do it. Whereas in 08, it was an earlier weekend like this, so I don't know what will happen this year. The second week in row, we row as much as we can. Unfortunately, you know, the weather in the spring can be just awful. Windy and cold and miserable. But we'll still row as much as we can. So all this land workout action we're doing now, we do as much as we can, as fast as we can. But the minute we don't have to do it anymore, we go right to rowing. And our championship used to be in mid-June. I don't know if that was only because things were looser back in the olden days, but also it allowed ice-bound teams like ours to compete on it, but not anymore. Now it's around the beginning of June. So. And anyway, we race those races, and then we're done about. And sore, which I've told you, was always a problem. There was a couple in 09. Sore started when we were at our championship. So we had a couple of kids who, a woman and a guy who graduated a couple of years before, they did it for us. But sore will, for example, should, our championship this year ends on Sunday. It had been Thursday, Friday, Saturday, but they're now changing it to Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So we'll fly back, get back 11 o'clock at night on Sunday. People, oh, it's off season. The next day at 11:30, we'll be recruiting. And it'll go to the beginning of August.
And then there's also this rowing club in the summer.
It's a U.S. development camp, which is a way that, and when I say legal, it's not like it's, you know, any kind of like criminal official legal. It's simply the rules of the NCAA, a development camp which is sanctioned by our governing body, U.S. Rowing. And we open it to kids from outside. And not a lot come, but some do. And my assistant coaches pretty much do that. I don't want to have much impact or much contact with my own rowers in the summer, even though I'm able to with the development camp. Part of it is you want to have them feel it's more fun and it's a looser environment, and that can't be if I'm there. So Just not that I'm not fun, but not to them, I'm not. Also, another innovation that we've had here, you know, we didn't have high school camps at all. And high school, and not only can it be a moneymaker, obviously, that's a practical side of it, but it's a recruiting tool. It's amazing. And I think the first one we had might have been four guys in the early 2000s. I think Greg Meyer, but I think it was more Scott Alwyn, who was class of 2001. He was one of our crack staffers, and he started it. Now he's the head lightweight coach at Columbia University. He's class of 2001. And so somewhere maybe in 02 or 03, he ran it. And then now it's up to, in the 80s, over three sessions. It's really fun anyway. It's about 15 practices, and it's 6 days, and we just emphasize in these high school camps the fun part of rowing. We don't need to scare anybody away. Mm-hmm. It's beautiful in the summer. They're having a good time. It's like they're at the beach, basically. And we do it concurrently with the girls' camp, so it's a big social event. So,
When did the boathouse get renovated officially?
They didn't give us, I don't know who they was, but we knew it was going to be starting soon in the summer of 2003. And we went down to Willows Beach, and we had that's where our temporary site was going to be. And I just remember being down there. It was fun, and clearing it out and cutting bushes and junk trees, not real ones, and clearing out a lot of space for ourselves in that summer. But we still didn't know exactly when it was going to happen. And then we all should have prepared better. And then all of a sudden they said, okay, Tuesday after Labor Day, it's all out, it's coming down. So that weekend before, we're all running around trying to get rid of everything. And then we had a tent go up there, and it was a circus tent, which we still use for spring break. And so we were in that tent officially, that would be, September of 03, all the way until January of 05. We did the land training in the winter, for the most part, was done over at the field house, which was really not a great place, but it worked out. So we had one entire year, 03, 04, and then the next year, just the fall. And coincidence or not, these were the freshmen that they were class of 08. They were seniors that year. So they had half of the tent. It was nice to get in here. So we got back from Texas in January of 05, and we came into this building, which was, spoiled now. Now I have there's all sorts of things about it I wish I would have helped design differently, but oh well.
Mm-hmm. I was going to ask you about that. So, I'm sure you could list ad nauseum.
There's a lot of wasted space with decks that are just not used. You think, wow, it's great. All these decks will have parties. When? In the summer? In the summer, our teams aren't officially, we're not intercollegiate. So it's just literally thousands of square feet of wasted space that we could use for indoor weight room, etc. Locker rooms are too small, dramatically too small. The women's locker room is the size we need, and for the women, they need about 50% more than they have. So these are all situations that hopefully we can rectify somehow. The doors are too small, too. Our boatman just took the measure of the doors for the boat base. He just took them off the old boathouse, but they could have been any size. I think they're 10 by 10. They could have been 12 by 14. They didn't care. I remember coming by, and might have been 04 on a launch, and they just had the facade, the concrete floor. I looked at the doorway. My God, they're too small. That's when I realized that was one of my biggest complaints. I was never, when you've come from a dump, which was what the old boathouse was, you're just so happy to have a shelter. Mm-hmm. It's typical, people that inherit sometimes or get a lot of money and they don't think about any details, just how much better it is than where they were. And then, the next thing they know, they're second guessing and questioning why they did what they did. And that's the way, don't get me wrong, it's a great facility, but there's a lot of things we could have done different.
Well, we just sort of focused on the negative there, but what are some of the, besides the fact it was a brand new building, and you say...
Well, it's just pretty self-contained, you don't have to share much, which is nice, because we have a lot of people here. You don't have to schedule, except for the rowing tank can do anything you want, anytime you want. You don't need to clear with any of our own teams or anybody outside, which is rare for most teams. And, you know, one advantage, giant advantage we have here, which has nothing really to do with the boathouse, but it kind of does, is that the dorms are right here. It's so handy for the athlete. You know, even in a place like Princeton, they always tell us, oh, we have a boathouse on campus. Well, from where you live to where the boathouse is could be 3/4 mile or more. Here, that could be true if you're at Southeast, but you're here at the Chope or these local, you're anywhere from 20 feet to a few hundred meters. Mm-hmm. It's a great place. And just being able to fit everybody at once is great, and train when we want. That's the best part about it.
Okay.
But it's nice. But I'm a accumulator, so I wish it was even bigger. That's the way I work.
Mm-hmm. I think when we all move into places, we immediately wish they were even bigger.
Right. Like, oh, boy. I don't know where you live now, but you probably lived in something smaller, right, before mm-hmm. you had kids. Yep. And when you moved into where you are now, you probably thought it was huge. And then about 3 weeks later, oh, my God, why didn't we do that? Or what were we thinking?
Mm-hmm. So the freshmen in 05 became seniors during the national championship season. Can you talk a little bit about your memories of that season?
Yeah, only one senior was it one or two? I forgot. Was in that boat, but he was a key player. That's without him in a 09, we couldn't win. Because he was so good, Derek Rasmussen. Derek had his uncle Jim Derby was one of the legendary rowers here, won 4 titles when he was here, and John Derby, his cousin, graduated in. He was technically class of 04, but he got injured 1 year of his class of 05. Now he's in engineering. I think he's getting his PhD right now in engineering, and his dad rowed here and his mom rowed here some too. He was good. He was the best guy from that class. Real good. It was just everything just aligned perfectly, and we had the right guys. So the two James brothers were the stern pair, and then you had Derek. So as important as the other guys were, it never would have happened without those guys. So, and these are walk-ons, all three of them. That's how you can win here. The problem is they don't come very often, as I said. Probably 1 in 10,000. And even though we had most of the guys returning, we had another senior in there in 08, because I remember we had 6 returning. I just don't remember who it was, to be honest. I can't remember. Jabba, by the way, had a lot of memories like I had that were stunted, forgotten, and I thought to myself when I first got here, I'll never forget things like he forgets, or forget names. I'm exactly the same way. I don't remember. I'm just like Jabba. I call guys by the wrong name, or say, what's his name? Old Jabba, I didn't give him enough credit. It's hard when you've been here a long time and there's a million different people that have come and gone. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, that was just a good boat. It was just as good in 2002. We were just as good. But I was a better coach in 2008. 2002, we won the Eastern Sprints. And we went up against a juggernaut, Cal, who had won 3 years in a row up to that point. We could have won that race, and we got second. I just didn't quite believe it that we were that good, but we were. They were good. Bo Hoopman, that Olympic champion, was in that boat. Mm-hmm. So they were just as good. We finished a little over a second back on Cal in that boat. So we've had 2 groups there that were just exceptional. But both of them did exactly the same thing. Both of them were based on juniors. Both of them lost key seniors. And both of them, those key seniors made a difference. And all, what is characteristic here, too, is that our freshman performances, since I was freshman coach, have been so spotty. We haven't had good reinforcements to come up and essentially either enhance, not to mention enhance, but even just maintain parity. So you have no one to fill. And what happens here with guys, and this is true on any team, if you're a junior and you're fast, and then you see there's no competition, really. And the same thing happened in 09 and in 03. Both years, we were good, real good, but not good enough because we lost a couple of key people, and then no one was pushing them. So that's one of the holy grails here, is not only having a great crew again, but also having some a decent freshman class come up. And right now, I got to say, you know, our senior class, if you looked at our numbers, it's not good. Our seniors were 9th at the championship. Our juniors were 14th, and our freshmen were 11th. That's terrible. Everybody else that's winning, 1st, 2nd. But that class that we won with in 2008, seniors were 13th. I think 09 would have been. No, it would have been 07. Seniors were 13th. I just got to remember this here. Juniors were 6th. And the lone sophomore was 13th. So it wasn't any better. So it can't happen. Man, no one else is doing that. No one. Everybody else has first-round draft choices, and they plug them in. We need to be more consistent. A freshman rowing and novice rowing is not any harder than it used to be. Just our coaches haven't got it done. It's not any harder. It's never changed. I mean, yeah, it's, things are a little faster than they were maybe 10 years ago, but not much. Mm-hmm. It's only so fast you can go. These aren't, you know, jet skis. They're just boats. So we need, and I hopefully this will be a big year. The freshmen are significantly better on paper, and they're performing at that. So there's some real bodies. We'll see, though. And then a couple of years from now, hopefully we'll be having, yeah, we're real good again. Mm-hmm. I sure hope so.
So how do you win a national championship? Do you go, I mean, obviously you compete in an event, but is it all points driven?
Well, you can, in our sport, I mean, we've won the team. My first 4 years here, I think we won the team. To win the event, though, the Big Eight, you know, the Varsity Eight, which is the big premier, you want to win that. And we did. So,
In 08, you won the Varsity Eight.
Eight, yeah. We were 2nd in 2002. Both years we won the Eastern Sprints. And in 08, we also won the team title at the Eastern Sprints, which is a big deal. We hadn't done that since the 1940s. It's really simple and easy to do if you got the right athletes. I'm sure if that happened, if most of the time we had the right athletes, I'd find a way to screw it up occasionally. But it's a lot harder to screw it up. And the teams that we go against, I can't tell you how much more talented they are and mature and professional they are. It's amazing how we compete with them with the type of people we have. But I'll take all those negatives if we have athletes, like rowing athletes, and most of the time we don't. We have a lot, if you look at them, frame-wise, they even right now, there's you walk up there today when they're rowing the rowing machine, wow, look at them. Yeah, but they're flawed in some way. Either they're not athletic enough, they're mentally not tough enough. It could be something. However, we have some younger guys who look like they have everything you need. So we'll see how that pans out.
So to be considered the national champion, you win the Varsity Eight, but you can be a team.
You don't have to win that. Yeah, if you
can win the team event, because it sounds like you've won the team
event. Yeah, and which is great, and it's a positive, but the real Holy Grail is winning that Varsity Eight. So.
Okay. Maybe just one more thing. Again, according to the athletics, the bio on the athletics website, you've taught, or coached, excuse me, American teams?
Yeah.
Mainly under 23 teams?
Yeah, most of it was before we had children, so that was the main reason. I was set to go to the Olympics and coach one of the boats in 2000, but the Olympics occurred in August of 2000 and we had our kids, so I didn't go. Which is, I don't consider it much of a, I would like to go do that sometime, but I got to worry about this team here more than I do. And the Olympics actually, you know, and it's ironic is that a lot of the boats have their own coaches. There's 14 events in rowing at the Olympics, 8 of which are men. And it's probably like a number of sports that people that would say that they're an Olympic coach are not nearly as good as your average college coach. Not even close. That's not true of the professional Olympic coaches. You know, there's Tom Terhar, who coaches the women, is an excellent coach. I mean, really, he's won a couple gold medals. It's good. Mike Tatey, who has coached them, is now a Cal coach. I mean, these are top shelf people. Mm-hmm. But to actually coach the events, sometimes if someone wins a trial, and then they bring along someone that rode at that was at their club to be their coach. So it's not, as far as being top of your profession, that's really not it. I have the most respect for the college coaches. They're good. Mm-hmm. And some go on to coach these events at the Olympics because their schedule allows it. But I have no interest in spending all that time away from my children now. So it could happen, though. But I'm not that. If we do it, we do it. But I'm not going to devote a couple years to it, put it that way. I can't do it.
Is that how it would have to be? I mean, if
it would be at least a year. Yeah. And just no interest. And the quote, I'm putting this in quotes, professional core of coaches switching a lot of the time, and you know, these, like I said, I at least half of them wouldn't make it as college coaches or are failed college coaches already. And they devote an enormous amount of time, and I'm impressed with that, but I can't do that. Almost none of them would be in my position with small children. So.
Okay.
But it would still be fun to do, there's no question, because I've been able to coach gold medals at the World Championships, the Pan Am Games, the National Championships, under 23 championships. It'd be nice to go coach a gold medal eight or any boat at the Olympics. But the Olympics are no different than anything else. You got to have the people. You have no chance. None. Mm-hmm. You're just going for the ride, get a free uniform, maybe make a final. Might get lucky and get a medal. But to win, you got to be special. And the U.S. has, you know, not as often as you would think. Part of it is because half the best, let's say that take the top 10 eights at the national championships, just in their order. Over 50% of the guys are foreign. So your farm team, your pool of athletes is just shrunk in half. So that's has a huge effect on our ability to develop, no question. And almost all of those places that use foreigners, the best guys on the team are foreign. So they would be equivalent of the starters. You could say anybody in the eight is a starter, but it's not really true. It's usually the stern four. Those people, they lead the team. And almost all of them, the good teams, are foreign. So not only are they taking seats, they're holding back the development of good Americans. So all this, in my opinion, some people might argue, but it's just, it's unassailable that over half the positions are held by foreigners. That's a fact. But that holds back Americans, and it's hurt our national teams. So we become a pretty good source of national teamers because we're all Americans, so. Okay. One of the few, if not the only one. Naval Academy usually has Americans, but they also have, because of their commitments to the military, aren't as easy for them to flit around a row after college like our guys can. So, but anyway.
So maybe just one more thing then. So Varsity 8, you're looking at the back of the boat would be the best?
The guys, you know, the coxswain in an 8, it's the ones closest to him.
Okay.
It's called the stern 4. Almost always they're the best people. And they're the leaders, the quarterback, QB. It's like the, you know, quarterback, essentially,
okay.
Stroke and that. Like, for example, I noticed right now at the University of Washington in a boat that they went to, they had 5 foreigners and 3 Americans. And the first American that appeared in that boat is in the 5 seats. The top 3 guys are stern, 3, 4. And that's typical, though. That's not unusual.
Mm-hmm.
But it affects the, because what you'll see is a lot of these good Americans that come from these places, they come to the national team, and they're not aware of the fact that, because they're young college guys, that someone else has been carrying the water. They've been in the fast lane, these guys, and you're drafting on them, period. And then all of a sudden, it's up to them to be the leader. It's not easy to do. Whereas I'd say there's a kid that wrote at Syracuse, which had a few foreign kids, but not many compared to some of these other ones, and he stroked Syracuse, and they haven't been that strong lately, but he definitely made them better. And they did pretty well last year at the championships. But he, it's a good example, though. He led his team. Mike Gennaro's his name, and hopefully he'll make the Olympics. And he's a real leader, but he led and stroked his team, even though there were some foreigners. But it's a good example of the type of personality that will make it. You know, he didn't have to sit backseat to anybody. So that's just another issue. A lot of people... It's controversial with some people, but not with me. I mean, I know if you said to any other sport, football, basketball, baseball, sports, oh, yeah, by the way, half your farm team is going to be filled by people that are ineligible to row for you. That would cause a hue and a cry and an uproar, but anyway.
Okay.
So, however, even though we provide people for national teams, they're so rare, the great ones, that, you know, we try to buck the trend and make it less rare, but it's hard to do.
All right. So that's all the questions I have, Chris. Anything else you want to say in closing?
No.
All right. Well, I guess we'll just wish for spring and for the ice to break.
Well, spring will be here, so don't worry about that.
This concludes the interview with Chris Clark. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.